But thank you for coming on this blustery night. I've been at Haverford for the last couple of days, and I've been reading there. So I haven't come all the way from England just today, just for this session, and I was down in Georgia at a conference before that. But it is really, really fantastic to be here again at Swarthmore, at such an important centre of Quaker studies, to talk about a book which I guess one might have thought would have come from someone studying here or at Haverford or at Penn, or someone who was kind of more on the inside, as it were. And it's rather puzzling how I get to be here, because I am, in many ways, an outsider. I'm not a Quaker. I'm not a Pennsylvanian. How did I get here? It's an interesting story. But I must say that when I said am an outsider, I think was an outsider is probably better, because what happened was I started coming here to Pennsylvania about 6 or 7 years ago to study this, and I've met so many people along the way here in Swarthmore and at Penn, where I was based at the McNeill Centre. And I've got so many friends now here, and I've had so much support and help. So thank you to all of you, and for the future as well, for making me feel so welcome. So what I'm going to be doing today, probably rashly, is trying to squeeze into 45 minutes or so headline material from a book which spans more than a century. So I apologise if at times my talk seems a bit kind of broad brush, but in many ways it's that long historical span which interests me. Because for most historians of the British abolition movement, the story begins in the 1780s, while many historians of American anti-slavery look back only in the most cursory way at events before the 1830s. And I didn't see the PBS program that was referred to, but apparently that was exactly what was happening there. Now, these later periods are, of course, important and fascinating areas for study. But today, I choose to see them as the end of a process, not the start. Instead, I'd like to explore the prehistory of abolitionism. And one of the most surprising realizations is just how far back in time abolitionist thought can be traced. Unfortunately, however, many of these early anti-slavery writings and discussions have been dismissed by historians who speak of lights shining in the darkness, isolated thinkers, or writers who had no impact. And it's astonishing just how often that phrase, no impact, is used to describe early anti-slavery writing. And I'd like to suggest this evening that assessments such as these arise from a narrow, or perhaps even a mistaken understanding of the meaning of the word impact. Now, the outlawing of slavery throughout the 19th century was, of course, a large and measurable impact. But the discourses that facilitated that impact, the things people said, the things people that they shared and repeated amongst themselves, what we mean by discourses, the discourses that facilitated that larger impact, although often dismissed, in fact have their origins decades, even centuries earlier. So let's start in England in the year 1657, in the last years of the rule of Oliver Cromwell, but in the early years of the Society of Friends. As you all know, Quakers faced a certain amount of persecution almost from the start, and in the 1650s, many were fined or imprisoned. And this led some friends to seek a new life on this side of the Atlantic almost from the beginning. Quaker populations were established in the newly founded British colonies in North America and the Caribbean, not, of course, in Pennsylvania at first, but also in Barbados and elsewhere. And within a year of the first Quakers reaching America, George Fox wrote a letter addressed to friends beyond sea that have blacks and Indian slaves. Now, it's just a short letter, and I'm going to condense it to make it even shorter. But it started a loud conversation. And at first, in fact, for the first century or so, it was really only Quakers who were in on this conversation. But later Quaker anti-slavery rhetoric was heard more widely. And after the 1760s began to change the world. And in this we reach, I think, something of a paradox, because Quakers who pride themselves on their silence, their moments of silence, on their plainness, in all things including language, might perhaps have been the last people we might have expected to have developed a public rhetoric of anti-slavery rhetoric. When we talk about vocalizing and taking our arguments to other people. And it's that paradox, which is one of the things I'm also going to think about this evening. And I'll start with that letter of 1657 from George Fox. It starts, "Dear friends, I was moved to write these things to you in all those plantations. God that made the world and all things therein, and giveth life and breadth to all. He is the God of the spirits of all flesh, and is no respecter of persons. But whosoever feareth him and worketh righteousness is accepted of him. And he hath made all nations of one blood to dwell upon the face of the earth. And he doth enlighten every man that cometh into the world, that they might believe in the Son. And the gospel is preached to every creature under heaven, which is the power that giveth liberty and freedom, and is glad tidings to every captivated creature under the whole heavens." Now, this is in many ways typical of Fox's writing, in which everything is repeated twice. It seems to be a hallmark of his personal style. Fox argues that God hath made all nations of one blood. He's created only one human family, and all members of this family are equal before the God who created the world. Nevertheless, while the letter clearly asserts the equality of human souls, it's far from being a call to emancipate slaves, be they blacks, Indians, or of any other origin. The key sentence argues that the gospel is preached to every creature under heaven, which is the power that giveth liberty and freedom, and is glad tidings to every captivated creature. Now, captivated here means captive. In other words, the gospel is available to all and brings joy to captives, slaves included. Now, while this is reasonably unambiguous, if you accept, as not everyone might have done, that slaves were captives, and even relatively uncontentious, I would have thought, the same cannot be said of the assertion that the gospel giveth liberty and freedom. Can that be right? Well, there are two possible interpretations. The first is that the word of God brings spiritual liberty to the individual, freeing them from the burden of sin. This type of spiritual liberty might indeed be glad tidings to captives bearing the weight of their crimes. But a second interpretation, and a far more radical one, is that a true understanding of the gospel confers freedom on the captivated. If this is the case, then captives of all sorts might walk free once they've embraced the light. Well, there's little evidence that this second meaning is the one that Fox had in mind. But this was put to the test when he visited Barbados and the British North American colonies between 1671 and 1673. On Barbados, Fox preached to both blacks and whites, and some of the slave owners felt that he was trying to encourage an uprising. They were taking literally the idea that that the gospel confers liberty and freedom. And we know that people felt that way, since Fox felt a need to refute that precise allegation in a letter to the governor and his council and assembly. Now, in this letter to the island's ruling Anglican plantocracy, as it was called, Fox writes that teaching the slaves to rebel is, I quote, "a thing we do utterly abhor and detest in and from our hearts. The Lord knows it, who is the searcher of all hearts and knows all things, and so can witness and testify for us that this is a most egregious and abominable untruth." And you can hear that double style that that Fox has there, with egregious and abominable, witness and testify and so on. And he follows this up by explaining to his reader what it is that has really been going on in these meetings. He writes in fairly forthright language. He writes, "For that which we have spoken and declared to them is to exhort and admonish them to be sober, admonish the slaves, that is, to be sober and to fear God, and to love their masters and mistresses, and to be faithful and diligent in their master's service and business, and that then their masters and overseers will love them and deal kindly and gently with them, and that they do not steal, nor be drunk, nor commit adultery, nor fornication, nor curse, nor swear, nor lie, that there are but two ways, the one that leads to heaven where the righteous go, and the other that leads to hell where the wicked and debauched whoremongers and adulterers, murderers, liars and thieves go." Well, as I said, quite a forthright statement. And this apparently is what was being preached to the enslaved people of Barbados by Quakers, or at least by George Fox. Okay, well, this might seem like a very local dispute, but it's an important moment for later Quaker anti-slavery because Fox is having to defend his practice of preaching to the enslaved people of Barbados. In other words, local politics is forcing him to formulate a global policy and to do it on the hoof, as it were. And in fact, we have an account of one of his sermons on the island that suggests his rhetoric was a bit more radical than he later liked to admit in his letter to the governor. According to one witness, John Hull, Fox spoke to Barbados Quakers about, and I quote, training up their Negroes in the fear of God, those bought with their money, and such as were born in their families, so that all may come to the knowledge of the Lord, so that with Joshua they may say, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, and that their overseers might deal mildly and gently with them, and not use cruelty, as the manner of some is and hath been, and to make them free after 30 years' servitude. So according to Hull, Fox had told Quaker slave owners on Barbados to treat their slaves humanely and to let them go free after 30 years. That might not amount to teaching enslaved people to rebel, but it certainly is a radical departure from the ways in which slaves were actually treated on the island. So did Fox actually say this? Well, probably he did, since this, or something closely resembling it, was reprinted in London a few years later, in 1676, as a book called Gospel Family Order, being a short discourse concerning the ordering of families, both of whites, blacks, and Indians. This explicitly addresses the question of plantation management in a text that represents both Fox's final position on the topic and his most polished rhetorical approach to it as well. And of course, I don't have time to read from it at length, but let's just compare the section that seems to be based on John Hull's account of the Barbados sermon. Here Fox quotes from the Bible, from Deuteronomy 15:12, "And if thy brother, an Hebrew man or an Hebrew woman, be sold unto thee and serve thee 6 years, then in the seventh year thou shalt let him go free from thee. This is a practice, Fox argues, that will doubtless be very acceptable to the Lord." But in translating this practice to the plantations, Fox somewhat alters the tariff. In Gospel Family Order, he writes, "To close up all, let me tell you, it will doubtless be very acceptable to the Lord, if so be that masters of families here would deal so with their servants, the Negroes and blacks, whom they have bought with their money, to let them go free after a considerable term of years, if they have served them faithfully. And when they go and are made free, let them not go away empty-handed. This, I say, will be very acceptable to the Lord." Now, this point about slaves going away empty-handed is from Deuteronomy as well, was an important corrective to the occasional practice of emancipating slaves only at a point in their lives where they were no longer able to labor or fend for themselves, a practice which was often effectively a death sentence. But Fox alters the word of the Mosaic Law, enjoining friends to let their slaves go free not after 6 years, as Deuteronomy suggests, nor even after the 30 years that the report of his original statement suggests, but only after a considerable term of years, if they have served them faithfully. So I think here at last we reach the limits of what we can understand from the phrase, "The gospel is preached to every creature under heaven, which is the power that giveth liberty and freedom," which was found in that letter of 1657. Clearly, Fox's final position is only that spiritual freedom, or freedom from sin, be conferred. Temporal freedom is still very much in the gift of the slave owner, comes only after a long stretch of hard labor, and can be achieved only by good behavior if they have served them faithfully, he says. While this might have been a crumb of comfort for some lucky slaves, one imagines that few indeed ever came to enjoy this retirement that Fox gestures towards. So Fox certainly urged amelioration of the slavery, of the condition of slaves of sorts, and manumission at times. But he does not at any point come even near to arguing for a general emancipation or for an end to either slavery or the slave trade, and still less, and at no point, for the general uprising that the Barbadian plantocracy had feared. So perhaps Fox had not gone as far as he could have done by 1676, and many historians of anti-slavery have said that this was interesting early stuff about slavery, but had no impact. But he had certainly gone a lot further than almost anyone else had done at that point. And for Quakers in the last years of the 17th century and throughout the 18th century, there was always an awareness that the founder had had severe misgivings about slavery, even if he hadn't come to a final outright condemnation of it. Indeed, the Quakers in Barbados found it increasingly difficult to adhere to their principles at the same time as treating their slaves as Fox had recommended. Now, although this was not the only factor, it was one of several that meant that by the early 18th century, most Barbadian Quakers had left the island and moved to Pennsylvania. And it was here that Quakers were to spend 70 years arguing and writing about the legitimacy of slavery before concluding it was something they could not tolerate. Now, the first Pennsylvanian discussion about slavery that we know about, in that it was written down, took place, as I'm sure you all know, in 1688, after a group of German settlers complained that slavery was against the Golden Rule. They said very plainly, "These are the reasons why we are against the traffic of men body, as followeth. Is there any that will be done or handled at this manner, viz. To be sold or made a slave for all the time of his life?" And they continue, "There is a saying that we shall do to all men like as we will be done ourselves, making no difference of what generation, descent, or colour they are. And those who steal or rob men and those who buy or purchase them, are they not alike?" And I think it's interesting that they call this a saying, the Golden Rule. And also that they say that the saying specifies making no difference of what generation, descent, or colour they are, which is something they have, in fact, themselves added in, unless it really was a saying at that time in that way. We don't know. I've not seen it in that form anywhere else. After that, almost every Quaker argument against slavery began by saying that slavery breaks the Golden Rule. And like the German protesters, most Friends who later proclaimed against slavery also equated slave trading with man-stealing. And these were powerful arguments, but they didn't get very far in 1688. The Germantown protest was passed up through local meetings, finally reaching the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, where it was debated and politely laid to one side. Now, later historians have repeatedly said that it had that it was buried or lost without trace at this point, forgotten, and therefore had no impact. In fact, its arguments resurfaced regularly at intervals over the next century. And at least two early historians of the anti-slavery movement, a very early historian, John Hepburn in 1715, and I'll come on to that, and Thomas Clarkson in 1808, were well aware of its existence. And the suggestion that it was without impact is somewhat belied by the fact that very shortly after the protest, various Quakers took it upon themselves to write books and pamphlets opposing slavery. And the first book to come out just 5 years later in 1693 was written by an anonymous supporter of the breakaway Quaker, George Keith, who, according to the minutes of the yearly meeting in 1688, had been in the room when the Germantown protest was debated, and in fact was one of a group of people who were asked to write a letter to London discussing the anti-slavery protest. So he clearly knew all about it, as did his followers. Now, of course, many historians have said that this tract had no impact, but nevertheless, it must have been part of the debate about slavery that impelled several Quakers to protest to the yearly meeting just 3 years later in 1696. And this protest was not entirely unsuccessful. The result was a pronouncement recorded in the minutes of the meeting that Friends be careful not to encourage the bringing in of any more Negroes, and that such that have Negroes be careful of them, bring them to meetings or have meetings with them in their families. And this is probably the first institutional attempt to limit slave trading in America. Although, of course, as many people pointed out, it didn't have any teeth for disciplining slave owners and traders. But this sort of alleged lack of teeth or impact more generally does not alter the fact that the ideas expressed in the several anti-slavery protests of the 1680s and 90s resurface regularly over the next few decades in a variety of publications. These ideas are never far beneath the surface. They're always bubbling up, and it's clear that what we've got written down is only the tip of an iceberg of a much bigger debate that's going on. And there are a number of publications that come out. One of the most important is a book, and I'm jumping a few years now, one of the most important is a book by a New Jersey Quaker called John Hepburn, which in many ways is the first really literary effort against slavery. published in 1715. His book, The American Defense of the Christian Golden Rule, can perhaps be seen as emerging from an abortive attempt by the Pennsylvania Assembly to outlaw slave trading in 1712 by putting a prohibitive duties on it. Now, that episode is worth a whole evening's paper in itself. But suffice it to say, it didn't succeed. In fact, I don't think it was ever meant to succeed. Pro-slavery Quakers seem to have been trying to fob off anti-slavery Quakers by giving the appearance of having attempted to take action, while knowing that the Privy Council in London would overturn the legislation. But the episode demonstrates that the slavery debate was very much alive in early Pennsylvania, and it also gave rise to a series of letters between London and Philadelphia. In one of these, in 1713, the London Yearly Meeting wrote to Philadelphia that, "We think meet to impart unto you, as the sense of the yearly meeting, that the importing them from their native country and relations by friends is not a commendable nor allowed practice, and we hope friends have been careful to avoid the same." So, on paper, at least, as early as 1713, the London Yearly Meeting had said that Quakers everywhere were not allowed to buy imported slaves, and of course they did, so it didn't take at that point. So the book, John Hepburn's book, American Defense, appeared in 1715, and although he doesn't refer to the recent goings-on in the Pennsylvania Assembly, he does begin by referencing the Keithian pamphlet and other earlier anti-slavery writings, and mentions Germantown as well. He says that these early writings are as rare as a phoenix egg. But the book goes on, in addition to presenting much kind of political and religious arguments, to become the first satirical anti-slavery work and the first to really use poetry to protest against slavery. Of course, it also makes much use, as the title suggests, of the argument that slavery infringes the Golden Rule. But that's not what's original about it. What he does for the first time in Quaker literature is to satirically invoke and place together two archetypes which would resonate throughout anti-slavery literature for centuries to come. The first of these archetypes is the sadistic and blood-soaked planter interested only in his own material gain. Hepburn characterizes Negro masters as men who can afford to keep themselves with white hands, except that sometimes they chance to be besparkled with the blood of those poor slaves when they fall to beating them with their twisted hides and horsewhips and other instruments of cruelty, too barbarous here to relate. Now, this is violent imagery, although it's not without its kind of implication of effeteness, with its emphasis on the slaveholder's white hands, of course, which contrasts with the black hands of the enslaved people. But this gives way to a more kind of obviously gendered construction, and another archetype, the vapid and self-obsessed wives of the slave owners, who, like Hepburn says, and this is another one of those odd passages, he says they like to paint their faces and puff and powder their hair and to bring up their sons and daughters in idleness and wantonness and in all manner of pride and prodigality, in decking and adorning their carcasses with puffed and powdered hair, with ruffles and topknots, ribbons and lace and gay clothing and whatnot. Now, this is a kind of Swiftian distaste for female adornment and indeed for female bodies in this vitriolic and, I think, frankly, misogynistic passage. The repetition of the invective against puffed and powdered hair, the objectification of women's bodies as carcasses, and then those rather limp concluding words where he kind of loses the plot and goes, whatnot. I think it suggests that he's not completely in control while writing this. Nevertheless, his characterization of planters' wives as Jezebel-like is consistent both with wider Quaker discussions about modesty in dress and appearance and with a developing stereotype of the planter's wife or daughter, which would become familiar to readers of later abolitionist literature. For example, some of you may know the image of the planter's wife in Anna Letitia Barbauld's poem of 1791, Epistle to William Wilberforce, Esquire, where she writes, pointing towards this woman, "Lo, where reclined pale beauty courts the breeze, diffused on sofas of voluptuous ease." Likewise, those of you who read Jane Austen might be familiar with her description of Lady Bertram in Mansfield Park. She's the wife of a planter who has plantations in Antigua, and she is in every scene continually diffused on sofas of voluptuous ease. And there are many, many other examples. So Hepburn isn't completely in control, at least in that passage, nor is he a great satirist by any means, but he is beginning to form satirical conventions that would later be widespread in anti-slavery literature. And his other innovation, which he also achieves, I think, only with mixed success, is to use poetry as an anti-slavery tool. Now, although some poets had paid attention to slavery by 1715, no one had really used it as a protest. Hepburn does, and although his verse can hardly be included among the great poetic achievements of the 18th century, by virtue of being the first anti-slavery poem, his attempts are important. Now, of the two short lyrics he produces, the first, which appears at the end of the preface, is the most successful. It's very short, and it goes, "And now to find the longitude, many a man hath gone about, but the perpetual motion our Negro masters have found out." Well, it's a very timely thing because there was a big search on at the time to find a method of fixing longitude. It was one of the great, great scientific questions of the day, and it would have saved lives of many mariners from shipwreck. And the other great thing, which would have been a wonderful discovery, perpetual motion, many people were looking for. And of course, he ironically points out that the slaves on the plantation are themselves in perpetual motion, and so that's that. Rather than being a scientific breakthrough, has already been found, but in a very brutal way. Now, Hepburn's book, I think, was original and important, but generally described as having had no impact. But nevertheless, in the years after Hepburn, the debate about slavery really took off in Pennsylvania and spread to Quaker communities in other parts of America too, particularly in New England, which is another story. Pennsylvanian Quakers soon began to produce more books and pamphlets, although very often they were written by people who were not exactly at the center of Quaker life. Two famous examples, who I'm sure you've heard of, are Ralph Sandiford and Benjamin Lay. Both of them almost best known outside of Philadelphia now through David Bryan Davis' assessment that their writing does not betray the slightest awareness of living in the Age of Enlightenment. Their books, Davis argues, drip with the blood and smell of the smoke and ash of hell. In Sandiford's case, at least, I think this is unfair. His 1729 book, A Brief Examination of the Practice of the Times, plainly emerges from a growing body of Quaker anti-slavery writing to which it both consciously refers and unconsciously alludes. More significantly, it's not merely a work of kind of, as Davis would portray it, of Christian enthusiasm directed towards a few faithful, but it's also a strategic intervention in a political debate which it aims to further. Its rhetoric certainly does thunder forth from the pulpit, but there's even moments of conciliation and political shrewdness. And his desire to position the book as a serious intervention in a public political debate is signaled in the opening pages with a lengthy dedication to my esteemed friend Matthew Hughes, Esquire, one of the representatives for the County of Bucks. Now, I looked up Matthew Hughes. If Sandiford's intention was to impress the reader with evidence of his access to the power brokers of the Pennsylvania Assembly, then he probably failed. Hughes, according to Caroline M. Peters, the only person who seems to have written anything on him, I quote, served 13 undistinguished terms in the Assembly, where he was remarkably inactive. That's not much of an epitaph. Neither is there any evidence that Hughes either supported or opposed moves to limit slave trading. Nevertheless, he may have been the best that the small shopkeeper Sandiford could manage in the way of patronage. And while the attempt seems somewhat ineffectual, we should note that Sandiford addresses his pamphlet to Hughes in his capacity as a secular legislator and not in his role as a prominent member of the Society of Friends. The book may be grounded in religious thought, but Sandiford was enough of a man of the Enlightenment to recognize that immediate social evils could only be remedied by duly elected officers of state. Accordingly, the six-page dedication, while not free from religious sentiment, is actually more firmly positioned in political and economic realities than most of the ensuing text. America, Sandiford argues, is prosperous enough that there is no need to go to Africa for bread, and that placing the burden which appertains to our bodily support on Africa is neither living by the gospel or maintaining liberty and property. Now, to such Enlightenment principles as liberty and property, he adds a solid understanding of the processes of the African slave trade, noting that Britain's original investment in trade with Africa had by now been recouped in the most unmerciful way, and that the nation's continuing involvement was the cause of both civil and domestic turmoil in Africa. And he is clearly writing about Britain, remember, it's part of the British Empire at this point, a British colony. Sandiford's analysis of the cause and effects of the slave trade, while not perhaps openly Republican, is certainly Whiggish, and he lays the blame at the door of the Stuart monarchy. The trade, he argues, and this is a long passage, but it's well worth listening to, the slave trade, he argues, is the fruit of a corrupt tree which was first planted in King Charles's time, when the African Company was commissionated for that trade, which no doubt was chargeable in shipping and forces to build forts. Yet covetousness, the motive to it, and root of all evil, soon paid itself without mercy, that to dispatch their vessels they would present a Negro king with a sword or such a matter, that he may war with his neighbours, and whichever party conquers, the fort is their market. Which proves a temptation to these poor creatures, privately to murder the strongest part of their neighbouring families, that they may sell the rest, though for the least baubles. And sometimes the betrayers and murderers they take also, and secure them with the rest in the vessel, lest surprised with their captivity, they should drown themselves. Oh, unrighteous gain! Now this passage contains, in a very compressed form, many of the most cogent arguments against the slave trade. That it stems from mistaken principles of foreign trade, that it is the cause of war in Africa, that it disrupts social and domestic relationships, and that it prompts slaves to suicide. Now, while it's certainly not inconsistent with Quaker principles, these are secular arguments rooted in Sandiford's understanding of the reality of the African experience. And to emphasize the point, Sandiford concludes his dedication by appealing to his patron Hughes as, and I quote, a living member in the body which you represent, and emphasizing that the ensuing treatise is, and I quote precisely, intended for the good of both church and state. And you'll notice that he says church and state there. While much of the ensuing treatise does indeed drip with the blood and smell of the smoke and ash of hell, as Davis would have it, it's plain that Sandiford's purpose is just as firmly located in the here and now. And it was in the here and now that Sandiford had impact. Although Davis dismisses it, the book raked up a new and important debate about slavery in Philadelphia society and prompted much discussion in Quaker meetings. And there was even an important advance. The Philadelphia Yearly Meeting decided to recommend to the care of the several monthly meetings to see that such who may be or who are likely to be found in that practice may be admonished and cautioned how they offend their herein. While admonishment and caution are not enough to prevent friends from involvement in slave trading, since no formal act of disunion could follow the caution, the Yearly Meeting's decision nonetheless represents a significant extension of anti-slavery discourse throughout the Quaker communities of Pennsylvania. From this point, monthly meetings are asked to investigate members who own and who trade in slaves and to admonish them accordingly. Now, an admonishment might not have held many terrors for the thick-skinned, but I suspect for many, the fear of undergoing the embarrassment of a public admonishment might have acted as a deterrent. But more crucially, the idea that the practice of buying Negroes is wrong is henceforth structured into the essential business and the ordinary language of the local monthly meetings. Giving them the task of monitoring and admonishing slave trading and slave holding in their local communities ensured that a discourse of anti-slavery would become an increasingly important part of Quaker identity in the second quarter of the 18th century. A discourse, I mean, people are talking about it. The words and the phrases are being shared and repeated, and the ideas being shared and repeated. Now, of course, this didn't go far enough, and some Quakers knew it. 10 years later, in 1737, Benjamin Lay wrote a book called All Slave Keepers That Keep the Innocent in Bondage, Apostates. Now, this, to be fair on Davis, really does reek of the smoke and ash of hell, and it's very chaotically disorganized. It's probably one of the least read books, I would think, in Quaker writing. And in fact, Lay is not best remembered for his writing, but for his stunts. As I'm sure many of you know, he's the one who smashed teapots and tobacco pipes in the marketplace to protest against those dangerous substances. He lay down naked in the snow in front of, or put his leg in the snow in front of the meeting house door to remind Quakers that the slaves that they passed by were not sufficiently well clothed to deal with the freezing weather. Whether he kidnapped or merely detained his neighbour's child, I've seen different accounts, so the parents would experience the same emotions as the parents of children abducted into slavery. And of course, his most famous stunt came when he got a chance to address the yearly meeting. His point was that by keeping slaves, Quakers were in effect committing an act of violence on the word of God or on the Bible. And to emphasise his point, as I'm sure you know the story, he took off his cloak and had a military uniform underneath, pulled out his sword and ran it through the book, splattering. Some people say, I think Benjamin Rush said it was blood, but others mostly say it was pokeberry juice. All over everyone. It was a dramatic enough meeting. And it had a fairly immediate effect in that Lay was disowned by the Quakers, taking an unusual step of putting two newspaper advertisements to actually say, look, he really is nothing to do with us anymore. Now, a lot of people recently, and in fact over the last 200 years, have seen Lay as a marginal figure whose eccentric testimony could safely be ignored by a kind of mainstream Quaker experience, and who therefore, of course, had no impact. To a certain extent, that may be true with Lay, and I'm sure many friends found his stunts and his zeal embarrassing. But at the same time, I think he was closer to the mainstream than we often think. But if we look at what some historians have said, many historians see the 1730s and 40s as a period of Quaker inaction on slavery. They'd gone so far, wouldn't go any further. Jean Sodland, for example, who, as many of you will know, wrote a very important history of Quaker relationship with slavery in the 80s. She notes that yearly meeting advice of 1730 to be cautious about buying imported slaves. But she says, for the next 23 years, this is as far as the yearly meeting would go. Not even Benjamin Lay could rouse them from their torpor. Now this, I think, is unfair. For a start, if nothing else, Benjamin Lay's stunts provoked a great many conversations between friends and neighbours. Indeed, his peculiar principles and conducts, argued Benjamin Rush, rendered him to many an object of admiration and to all the subject of conversation. So people would talk about Benjamin Lay and they'd say, well, he's against slavery, and conversations about the morality of slavery would spring up as a result. And it seems like these conversations were having impact. In the period when Lay was performing his stunts, the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting was not torpid. It was, in fact, regularly raising the slavery question and regularly seeking assurances from monthly meetings that friends were obeying the advice to be cautious about buying imported slaves. And such assurances had been sought at least from the 1735 Yearly Meeting, 2 years before Lay published All Slave Keepers Apostates, which somewhat suggests that his campaign was closer to the mainstream than is often recognised. And in fact, rather than being a period of torpor, the period 35 to 43 marked a profound shift in the attitude of Philadelphia Quakers towards buying imported slaves, which we can trace by following the minutes of the yearly meeting. And it began with a simple but repeated request that friends follow the advice of 1730. Minutes for 1735 note that this meeting, also agreeable to former advice, thinks proper to repeat the caution to friends against encouraging the importation of Negroes by buying them after imported. This caution was reiterated the following year, but with an added request. The meeting recommends it to the several quarterly meetings belonging to this meeting to be careful in the verges of the meetings in this particular. Verges, the kind of, I'm not sure what a better word for that is, but the constituency, if you like. In other words, the yearly meeting is no longer merely throwing out generalized advice, but delegating responsibility to the quarterly meetings to ensure that the advice is made clear to everyone within their verges, or jurisdictions, I suppose. This request suggests that some of the monthly meetings charged with that duty in 1730 were not doing as asked. And to enforce this, the yearly meetings establishing a kind of a chain of command, if you like. The following year, the screw was tightened even further. In addition to repeating the former advice, the yearly meeting now also asked the several quarterly meetings belonging to this meeting not only to be careful in the verges of their respective meetings in this particular, but to return an account thereof to the next yearly meeting. Not satisfied merely with delegating responsibility, they're now holding them to account. For the third year in a row, their authority in this matter had been incrementally extended. This is not torpor. The fourth year would demonstrate how successful a policy had been. After hearing oral reports from delegates in the quarterly meetings, as well as enjoying the dubious pleasure of being spattered with pokeberry juice by Benjamin Lay, the yearly meeting again advised against buying slaves after importation, presumably to Lay's great annoyance and possibly even to annoy him. They allowed themselves a moment of self-congratulation. Diverse friends in this meeting, the minutes note, expressed their satisfaction in finding by the reports of the quarterly meetings that there is so little occasion of offence given by friends concerning encouraging the importing of Negroes. And this meeting desires the care of friends in their quarterly and monthly meetings may be continued. Now, this was probably a pointed rebuke directed at Benjamin Lay. And also, I suspect that there was more slave trading going on than they actually claimed in this. Nevertheless, it's hard to avoid concluding that by 1738, friends had very much reduced the practice of buying slaves, at least those who had been recently imported from Africa. Now, after this moment of self-congratulation, the yearly meeting might well have chosen to rest torpidly on their laurels, but they did not do so. Instead, the message is continually pressed home. The minutes for 1739, 1741, and 1742 all contain nearly identical notes repeating their caution against importing Negroes. And quarterly meetings are continually asked to send reports to the yearly meeting. So, you know, they're really keeping it up. And it appears that these repeated cautions did have an effect on friends. For example, as many of you will have read, John Woolman reports in his journal for late 1742 or early 43 that he felt uneasy when he wrote a bill of sale for a slave which his employer was selling to an elderly Quaker. He temporarily abated this uneasiness by speaking out against slavery, but when shortly after another Quaker asked him to write an instrument of slavery, he declined to do so. Now, significantly, it wasn't just Woolman who was uneasy on this occasion. It wasn't just his uneasiness. Woolman spoke to him in goodwill, and the other friend told him that keeping slaves was not altogether agreeable to his mind, but the slave being a gift to his wife, he had accepted of her. And this example suggests that by early 1743, the buying and selling of slaves was the cause of some social embarrassment for Quakers in Pennsylvania. It's also further evidence that discussion of the morality of slaveholding took place outside meeting houses as well as within them. In the same year, however, the minutes of the yearly meeting makes its last mention of slavery for almost a decade, which to a kind of cursory observer might look like torpor. But this is not because it's dropping the issue. On the contrary, it takes the decision to incorporate the 1730 advice into the queries. A new list of queries are drawn up. There's 12 of them at this point, which, according to the... I was just talking about this at Haverford yesterday. According to the yearly meeting minutes are to be read at the quarterly meetings, but we think may probably also have been delegated down to the monthly meetings as well. I'm not absolutely sure about that. But certainly it says quarterly meetings in the yearly meeting minutes. So even without formal powers of sanction or censure being invoked, considerable social pressure would have been placed on friends to conform to expectations by giving the correct answers. So it's really important that in this new list of queries, question 11 is, do friends observe the former advice of our yearly meeting not to encourage the importation of Negroes nor to buy them after imported? So with this query, the commitment not to buy imported slaves is transformed from being just one piece of advice to actually being part of the central essence of Quaker identity in the colony. From this point onwards, at least friends, at least weighty friends, and at least in quarterly meetings, and possibly more widely, are asked to stand up and affirm regularly that they and members of their community have not bought imported slaves. Whether intentionally or not, the yearly meeting had given anti-slavery discourse what was perhaps its most important boost at any point during the 18th century. And I don't mean just for Quakers, I mean anywhere. Because what they're doing is they're allying anti-slavery very closely with a group identity. And they made it very difficult for any Quaker to buy imported slaves without very publicly admitted to having let down the standards of their friends, families, and communities. So with this, Quaker anti-slavery rhetoric became Quaker anti-slavery ritual. And the psychological impact, no less than the political impact, of locating anti-slavery at the heart of Quaker identity cannot be overemphasized, I don't think. Now, a little more than a decade, this ritual became much, much stronger. You will all know that in the mid-1750s, the Quakers in Philadelphia moved much more strongly against slave trading and indeed slave owning. And this has been very well examined, this particular episode. Most of you know the story about John Woolman writing some considerations on the keeping of Negroes, the first Quaker anti-slavery book publicly supported by the overseers of the press. And from there, between 1753 and 1758, convincing the yearly meeting to unambiguously outlaw the purchasing slaves, crucially with the pain of disunion included in that. And I think it genuinely was Woolman who was the force behind the Philadelphia Quakers' decision to denounce slavery in the 1750s. But of course, no amount of force can move an immovable object. Woolman had to be pushing at an open door. So why this time? It's a difficult question to answer, but it appears that simple economic explanations are not enough. If Quakers wanted to keep on keeping slaves, there was plenty of money to be made in the business, as you could see by looking around anywhere else in British America or even beyond. They gave up their slaves for moral, that is to say, cultural reasons, not economic ones. And as Jean Sodland shows, the decline began in the 1730s, at the same time that Benjamin Lay was spattering them with potpourri juice. And there are several explanations for this. One is that slave ownership was indeed no longer profitable, but given, for example, the clamour of Georgia at that time to embrace the plantation system, this hardly seems plausible. Another possible explanation is demographic. Slaves acquired by Quakers in the late 17th and early 18th century would only rarely have survived past the 1730s and produced relatively few children. But the argument that slave ownership declined because the slave population was dying off depends on Quakers not replacing their slaves when they died. In other words, a demographic explanation for the decline in Quaker slave ownership is ultimately a cultural explanation. And in my analysis, many Quakers have been heeding the advice given repeatedly over and over again in many different forms from 1696 by both the yearly meeting and in other publications, the advice not to buy imported slaves. So all things considered, the most likely explanation is in 1750s is that a younger generation of friends brought up in a climate where anti-slavery discourse, where the talking about slavery, talking against slavery was widespread and current. This generation were asserting the values of their generation by choosing not to replace the slaves that they inherited from their parents. This implies that the debates of the past half century had considerable cultural influence. Although the impact of any particular individual event, such as the Germantown protest, the 1696 advice, the Hepburn's book, the 1730 advice, and all of the rest of them, although none of these could be directly or immediately measured, taken together, it represented a substantial cultural investment in anti-slavery. And this investment was rewarded in the 1750s when a new generation came to the fore. Pennsylvanian Quakers outlawed the purchasing of slaves in the 1750s because, I say outlawed, I mean within the Society of Friends, not obviously in colonial law, but they did it in the 1750s because slave ownership had declined in the 1740s because the arguments had been won in the 1730s and before. And then just a few years later, in 1761, The London Yearly Meeting would follow their lead and issue what they called a strong minute, debarring all friends from trading in slaves on pain of disunion. And this is all over the world. Now, thereafter, and of course there's another whole story to be told about what happens from that point, but thereafter, London Quakers would be instrumental in establishing the non-denominational national movement against the slave trade that bore fruit in the 19th century. No single high-impact event kick-started this abolition movement, but instead it had its origin in hundreds of low-impact cultural and discursive events, any one of which on its own can be dismissed as having had no impact, but which cumulatively, over the course of more than a century, added up to one of the most important developments in modern world history, the start of the international campaign to abolish slavery. Thank you.